What we have left out so far is a certain phenomenon that we see in languages like C, where we can have expressions between the sub-expressions of different types. For example, you could have something like a sum between two integers, which is just the ordinary thing. Then you could have also the sum between two floating point variables or expressions, which is actually a different implementation that is used in that point, but you just don't see it at the surface. You just implement plain C expressions. And for that, it is actually quite useful to have the knowledge of the exact type for that sub-expression in order to choose the right implementation of the overloaded operator. However, this is not the only thing that can happen, because actually there is also expressions with which have two sub-expressions of different type, and in these cases you see also does something. And what is it that is done? Well, you have the phenomenon that you get a kind of automatic conversion between types, which is called the coercion. So the idea is there that there are types that are more general than others, and in cases where one of the sub-expressions has a more specific type and the other one a more general type, you can convert the more specific type into the more general type and then use the implementation of the operator that belongs to the more general type. What does that mean in practice? Well, you all have seen something like that. If you program with integers together with floats or doubles, then if you have a mixed typed expression, like the sum over here, then you will have an integer as one of the operands and a float as the other one. And what does the system choose? Well, it's the more general option of the two, and which is, well, in our case, float, because in theory, you can have all the integers represented as floats. So that is what coercion is all about. That is something that we haven't covered so far in our typing rules. In C, for example, there is a whole chain of these more special or more specific type relations, which is just for plain integers. So you can have different lengths of data types. There's characters, which is just the most basic data type, then the shorts, then the ints, and after that even the longs. So that's a pretty lengthy chain. And each of these data types can also be attributed whether the data type should actually interpret it to be signed or unsigned. So there's also another modifier over here. And the rule says that you have room for you can convert the smaller data types into the larger ones. So you can convert the characters into the shorts into the integers, and integers into the unsigned ints. Yeah, and if you encounter expressions which have different types, you have to get to the you have to promote the more specific one until it becomes the same type as the more specific as the more general one. Yeah, That actually opens a lot of room for errors. Can anyone see the error in here? Obviously, it must be something with the types. So the central thing that might go wrong is probably related to here. Yeah. Well, I hope that you would be able to help me at some point, so I have to figure it out myself now. yeah, anyway, the only thing where something is gonna can go miss is where we actually are interested in the size of the type somewhere. So there's, for example, this one where we have a size of the array, but in this case I don't see any problem related to that. We have the size of for the whole array, so that should be fine. Yeah, that sets the memory to zero for that one. Okay, so we have a while loop over the content of the string pointer, or of this character pointer, and we do indexed access on, well, where do we index? Here on the content of the character pointer, but we take the unsigned version of that. Well, you also see the note over here. Unsigned is something which is the shorthand for the unsigned int. Well, this should then interpret the characters that are in there as an unsigned integer for that. Well, that's thought of as an error here. Mm-hmm. Well, nice. Okay. And afterwards, the whole thing is just incremented. I'm actually not quite convinced. That's one of the examples that has been here from my predecessor, so I'm not quite sure what the whole algorithm is actually supposed to do. But I'm guessing that it's to do with that he wants to interpret the string components as different characters and wants to cast them into its unsigned interpretation. Well, yes, but that I think that's more or less related to the fact that you can just do this thing. So I'm not sure whether that's really with promotion. Yes? Probably. Well, it might be that this cast then just interprets a larger fraction of the array as one number if you do so, and it will then take the unsigned int version, which has just more characters, and maybe this is the cause why the whole thing would go out of bounds, but yeah, I think it's a little bit constructed. Okay, so Anyway, what we wanted to do is talk about subtypes. So there's this concept of a whole subtype hierarchy. What does it mean when I talk about a subtype? Well, for once, I think of subtypes as kind of a relation between two types. So I say for this symbol here, I say that T1 is a subtype of T2. And if I say so, what do I mean? I mean that the values that the type for T1 actually covers form a subset of all the values of the type T2, and that I can convert all the values that are of type T1 into values of type T2, and that I don't run into any problems with that, because then the values will fulfill all the requirements for type T2. So that is what a subtype is actually about. And where can I use it? I can use it for assignments, for example, when I have an expression on the right-hand side and some location on the left-hand side, or some variable or memory location or whatever, then I can assign the left-hand side to the right-hand side to the left-hand side if it is actually a subtype of the left-hand side. So the intention is that the right-hand side is must have at most as many values as the type for the left-hand side. Thus, and also they are a subset of the values of the left-hand side, so I will, can for sure store them in their destination. Yeah. Of course, that is just with plain types, and that's a little bit boring, so we can try to introduce this new interesting relationship into the calculus that we had the last time. So we're going to extend our complex type system with subtypes now. And what is the general intention behind that? That is something that is already going into the direction of what will be later on object orientation. For example, in structs, which are the, kind of the basic components that we will use for constructing objects later on, I might have a notion of a subtype if I can use the subtype in all places where I could originally use the basic type. So what does that mean for structs? Well, that's not like here. The idea would be that the subtype must be able to keep to the constraints that the basic type will have in the code. So what are these constraints? Well, the subtype must be able to deliver the same access paths that can be done with the basic type. So my structure, when it has certain accessors, then my subtype must at least have the same accessors. And for all the values that are stored inside in connection with these accessors, those values must also have the subtype relation. So they must be a subset of the values that can be used in the original basic type. So if I introduce that into my subtyping calculus, then I would see these relations once again as, or in this case, it's not so plainly visible. I would see these as components where I want to prove that the left part is a subtype of the right part. So, what I need to introduce, of course, is rules where I do all my type conversion and coercion that is implicit in my language. So I would add a lot of concrete rules for the concrete types. For example, this thing between ints and characters, where my character can be promoted to an int. So this would be something that I would add to the whole system. But apart from that, I would have a look at the comparison of complex types. So if I have exactly the same type expression and want to know whether they are subtypes, well, in these cases we're done, so that's fine. If we look at two pointers, well, same as for the structural comparison, we can just remove the pointer operator. When we look at some type definition, then we will just inline the type definition. So there's nothing different than just ordinary structural typing. The first thing there where we see a difference is in the typing for structs. So if we have two structs, when is the left one a subtype for the right one? For once, I have to match the accessors once again. But instead, instead of the version that we had for structural equality, there's one crucial difference, and this is in the way that I keep my indices, for example. And this already indicates that there is something going on with the indices here. And actually, the thing is that for a subtype, you can introduce new accessors, new attributes, or new fields in my struct. And it's still able to live with the same constraints as the basic type. So this guy over here is actually able to have more accessors than the right one. So this JM is something which is at least as large as this K. Okay, what does that mean? Well, in this subtyping on complex types, I can, for example, define my variable with this type of this structure here. Another variable which has kind of the same definition but just one property or one field less than the other one, and still I will be able to assign access values to Y because it can still fulfill the same requirements as Y. So what we should take away is for the structures in with subtyping. This struct is actually a subtype if it has at least as many accessors, and all of these the accessors that the basic type has are actually accessors of my subtype. And for each of the types of the accessors, we also have the subtype relation once again. So that's what we should take away from that. So there's only one thing remaining, which is the type for functions. And in this case, once again, we look for the subtype relation. So, yeah, we will have for the return type here, subtype relation, for the first parameter, subtype relation, until the end of all my parameters, I will have subtype relation. So, for example, let's check whether this is actually correct for the structs. Is there a subtype relation between those two? And if so, which one is the subtype? Like this?
Yes.
Why? But maybe you're still right.
Well, in that case, because integer is a subtype of fold with regards to the field A.
So, what would you say? Still right or wrong?
Well, you can say.
Well, for once, what you need is are all accessors that are present here already also here? Well, they are. There's A. Then we need to have a look at the types. So float and integer. And how must the types be arranged? So that the whole thing is a subtype? Well, this one must be the subtype of this one. And, well, is it?
I think so.
It is. So integer is the... If you think in the values, you can store in a float all the integer values. So it's the subtype here. Okay. Yes, please?
Does we have to swap the accessors in the example? Because the first one has 0 and T0 in the order, and Q1 and S1 are swapped.
You mean these two? Do they have to be swapped?
If they should correspond to the first one?
Like this one? Should they? I was actually hoping for you to run into problems over here by just not pointing that out to you, but actually this is a problem that you've discovered here. And let's think a little bit together, probably on the example, to see whether it has to be swapped or not. So let's think of this one. Is there a subtype relation between these two? Why not? Mm-hmm. So this one over here for sure is not a subtype of the left one.
No, it is not.
Okay.
Because the argument would be okay. So you give an int argument and convert it to a float, that would be okay.
Mm-hmm.
But when you want to return the result, you want to stuff a float into an integer variable, and that's not possible.
But maybe this one is a subtype? Like this?
Should we consider the rules for web practice from the last lecture?
Well, probably this one and the other ones, but in this case it's only this one that is relevant. Yes, please?
I think it is not, because if it would be forced to int be a subtype of float and float be a subtype of int, so in both ways it
this is if you keep to these clauses like here, but there's also the thing that if you think about it in a more intuitive way, if this would be a valid relation, then you could assign such a method to or a pointer to such a method to a pointer to such a method. And in these cases, the resulting value would have to deal with all the constraints that are out there. So there must be, for example, also the constraint that you have a method call that is done with floats, for example. And the subtype, or if int would be a subtype of the other one, it would be able to cope with a method call that has floats, so to say. So that's the intuitive explanation. But apart from that, it's these rules. They are actually correct. So you have to flip them around. So that is the correct way to specify it. Actually, only this one is the correct subtype, where you have the float as parameter type and integer as a return type. This actually can be a subtype of a method that expects integer as parameters and gives a float as a return. Yeah, that's there's a small speciality here, and this also has a name, and the name for that is that you have to differ in subtyping between the result type and the parameter type. And for the result or return type, we have a so-called covariance, which means that the return type is varying in the same way as my intended type variation of my composed type, which is the functions themselves. So if the function S0 continuing with S should be a subtype of the function with T, then the return types should have the same subtype relation. They are going together, so that's a covariance here. And for the arguments, it has to be the other way around. They have to be contra, so it's a contravariance here. So for each of them, the T types must be the subtypes of the S types. So that's what subtyping for functions mean. Okay, so there's also an example from the functional languages. Yeah, but it's just the same as you have seen before. So in this case, it's just that the return types are mentioned here and the parameters are here. Yeah, but apart from that, there's the same relation. Okay. Yeah. So we can now try this out in a few examples. So let's have a look at those. The query for which we emanate is we want to check whether S1 is a subtype of R1. So let's start with that. S1 and R1, let's have a look into how you compose these two types. So we have S1 and and R1, and both of them have A accessors. There's also B accessor, which is not present in both, and there's an F accessor. So first of all, which one is is supposed to be the subtype? This is S1, so it is okay for S1 to have an additional accessor. Fine, so we don't need to bail out at that point. Apart from that, we now can draw the edges for the two accessors that are remaining. And if we follow A, we get the types int and int, and int is a subtype of int, so that's fine. And we can check for the accessor F, and we get for once we get R1 and R1, and for the other one we get S1 and S1. Yeah, so what do we have to do then? We have to split into the return value, or the return type here, and the parameter type here. And for the return type, we have covariance, so we need to have the same subtyping as we have in the original function definition. So we need to prove S1 is a subtype of R1. Well, we are in the query for S1 is a subtype to R1 already, so this is kind of the recursive call to this query, so that's okay, we can finish here. And now we have to just to do the same thing for the contravariant parameters, and I wonder, what do we see? R1 must be a subtype of S1. And this is exactly the same query as the other one, but just the other way around, which is a bad thing because we are in the manner of proving that S1 is a subtype of R1, and both of them are not the same. So if this is actually true and they're not the same, then this will never be able to be true. So at this point, we can just bail out and say, no, S1 is not the subtype. Yes?
So we don't bother with the order of the LMS vector elements. So in that
it's just
application, that would matter because they have different offsets in memory when copying.
If you take the C semantics, then you run into problems with the memory layout, definitely. Yeah, but that's not what actually should happen in C. So that's kind of artificial. It's just upgrading C to something which is more aware of these accessor things. It's also already half the way to something like C# or Java, which is more accessor based. If you would have, if you have the same names, but the same semantics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what I left out here is there's these intermediate steps. Let me go back. These ones. I didn't draw them anymore because the trees would just continue to grow. But I would have to. To insert them in here. And,
But still, when we end up in the same situation, if, let's say, of the S1, we just leave out the int. Twice the same thing, but the functions still do not.
I got you wrong at that point, yes. Yeah, in these cases, I think the it's a little bit. It would not be sufficient to just look at the symbols here. I think we would have to do something different over here and not give different names to them. It does not quite fit into this way of doing it, but yeah, the goal would be to have unique names for structurally completely equivalent things.
So would be the goal to give them the same name in the first place if they are identical?
If they're actually identical, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you do so, then you can try to, if you already suspect that one of these trees will actually, or that these are actually not subtypes, you can actually try to enforce to come to a point where you are in the situation where you have exactly the opposite as you started from. So that's kind of a strategy when you do these calculi. So I think you would have to manipulate your initial values. Yeah, I think I just have a lot of them because there's actually one, other example coming. So this, it's three examples, so I need a lot of different situations. Okay, so that's manipulate that. So what we did before was S1 and R1. Now let's change the whole thing a little bit and introduce another S1, another S2, for which we want to do the subtyping checks. So once again, we have structs, and we have S2 and S1. So it's this one and this one, and they have B and A, so that's both integers, so we can have this branch closed. That's fine. Then the only thing that's remaining is F, so we generate a new branch for that. And yeah, we have to compare the types S1, S1, and S2, R2. So we have both of them here. For S2, we have the S2, R2, yeah, that's fine. And now, for these, we have to do covariant subtype checking. So we do S2 as a subtype of S1. This is the same thing that we had already, so we are done in this branch. For the parameters, we have S1 and R2, and we have to do it in a contravariant way. So S1 goes here and R2 goes here. Once again, we do subtype checking. And these are structs once again. So let's clear that away to have a little bit more. S1 and R2, both of them are structs. And we have A over here, which is both of them common. So in this case, we are done. We have, that was not the same A. So these over here. Then we have another B, but B is in the supposed subtype, so that's okay. We don't have to deal with that. Then we have F. F successor is this one. This will make us compare subtypes for S1, S1, and R2, S2. Yeah, we have covariant return types, so S1, R2 is the first thing. S1, R2 is something which we have already seen, so this can be closed. And for the parameters, we have contravariants, so we will end up with S2 and S1, which we have seen here already, so we're done in this case also. So we have depleted everything, and we've seen that subtype relation is actually valid between those two. So that's what you do for these things. You just insert the types, you keep to the rules that you had. If you end up with an exercise for that, you should probably check whether you have subtyping in there, whether you have structural equivalence in there, and according to these, you can choose the right rule set. Okay, so there's another one, but I think you can also check that at home, because today we want to continue with the next topic, which is code synthesis. Okay, so after we have successfully type-checked our program, the next phase would be either to try to come up with some optimization, but now that we already do compiler generation for, I think, 9 or 10 iterations now, I think we're ready to produce a little bit of code now, so that's what we're going to do right now. What we can emanate from is the syntax tree that was, or the attributed syntax tree that is what was left from our typing analysis before, and the parser and the scanner and everything that came before. And what we want to do now is we want to generate code, and that is something that can be also done with a kind of attribute system, considering that something like the code is just another attribute that can be synthesized from the branches in our attribute or in our syntax tree. Alternatively, you could also see the whole thing as a kind of recursive code generation function that we specify for our grammar, for the grammar objects. Okay, for our lecture, what we're going to talk about is generation of code for C-like language. So we will roughly keep to the C standard for the statements and the expressions that we're going to create code for. And what we also need is some kind of machine instructions for which we will create code. So as practical architectures are quite complicated and have a lot of KVADs and special things, we will not treat a concrete machine architecture here, because we want to keep it quite simple and to the core principles of the whole thing. So for that, we will introduce our own special type of machine, which is the registered C machine. Yeah, what are the shortcomings of the whole thing? Well, for this system, there's no actual processor that can execute it. That's a pity, but yeah. So no processor for us. But of course, well, if you don't have a processor, you can probably write an interpreter for that, especially when it is something so simple as our register C machine. And actually, that is also one of the purposes of such a virtual machine. If you keep it very simple, you'll probably be able to write an interpreter for that, probably even in machine language for your target machine. So you'll end up with a quite fast interpreter, and yeah, that might also be a boon. Okay, apart from that, what we also have for that machine is a visualization environment. So when we do experiments with register C machine code, we can watch it, process our hopefully correct programs. What we also won't do is deal with complicated stuff like doubles, floats, or this whole hierarchy of integer data types. That's something that is not very difficult to do, but it makes a lot of the code generation functions quite longish, and you have to do a lot of typing without any intelligence involved. So we'll keep our machine free of that and just keep to the core, which is for us just plain integers, which will be machine integers. Yeah. Also, what we won't do is communicate with the operating system in any meaningful way. That's also something which is not really compiler relevant. That's just some kind of conventions that you need to have with your compiler or with your runtime that will enable you to do so. So we will keep our hands from that. And yeah, the last thing that we will do different from concrete machine architectures is that we will use an unlimited supply of registers, which is seems in the first hand quite generous. But yeah, that we're not the only ones who do so. These concepts of a register virtual machine are quite far spread, and two very famous other projects also use, for example, unlimited registers. So LLVM, does anyone know the LLVM or has used? Okay. So have you seen the intermediate code for the LLVM already? Well, probably people who have heard or listened to the programming languages last year may have seen a fraction of the LLVM intermediate code already. So it's quite a high-level assembler language or machine architecture that is intended to be used inside a compiler. And one of its features is that you don't have to deal with a limited number of temporary variables, but you can just get yourself another variable if you need it. So it has unlimited supply of temporaries, which are kind of the equivalent of registers. And the other one is the Dalvik VM. Has anyone heard of that?
Is that the one in Android?
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So for a long time, it has been the virtual machine implementation for the Android runtime. I'm not sure whether it is already completely superficial right now. Superfluous. Well, whether it has been replaced with the I think was it Art or something. Is it actually completely replaced, or did they just say default is
completely replaced
already?
All the versions of Android, I think, so 4.1 or so, is still included.
Hmm.
So it will take some time until it dies out.
I'm actually not sure whether Art is something that also has a level comparable to the Dalvik VM, or whether it already compiles through everything and just has machine instructions, so I'm not sure about that. But for Dalvik, at least, it was kind of a quite similar thing to the Java Virtual Machine, except for the Java Virtual Machine is a stack machine, while the Dalvik VM is a register machine. So it's these two concepts, and if you happen to also listen to the Virtual Machines lecture, for example, then you'll have the stack machine notion of a virtual machine for C there, and here we are doing the register machine. So these are kind of two ways of doing it. In the end, you will end up with the same thing. Okay. So what about virtual machines? What do you need for such a virtual machine? Of course, you need to come up with instructions that make up what you can do with that machine. And these instructions are meant to be executed on virtual hardware. So you need to specify what, for example, memory and special registers are actually composed of. Yeah, then there's, in many cases, there's also some kind of runtime system that has advanced features like the memory management, free memory. So there's in the simplified virtual machines, there's always just a malloc that you can call, and memory is automatically or conceptually automatically freed, and you always get an unlimited amount of memory. But that's something that's it's handled by some kind of runtime of the whole system. Yeah, the interpreter is a special component of the runtime, and the interpreter is the one that takes your instruction sets or instruction sequences and executes them on the virtual hardware. What is typical components of a virtual machine? Well, for example, for the for Java, what you need is a kind of a code memory or a code area in the memory where you store your instructions. For simplicity reasons, we will just say that each instruction is kept in one cell, so that we can just enumerate the cells one after each other, and if we want to switch to the next instruction, we can just increase our program counter, which is a special purpose register that keeps just a pointer on the actually at the moment processed instruction. Yeah. What we also need is a stack. This is the place for our for our data that we accumulate during function calls to be laid out at, and as soon as we call another method, we can store our temporary data on the stack and increase the stack pointer, which is another special register that we will use on our machine. I think, the stack was something that we had already here, stack pointer and the stack, and now we are also seeing the C, which is the code memory. The program counter, so that's for you at home. Then what does the actual interpreter do? If we provide it with the hardware that we've seen, the code memory and the program counter, then it will always execute the same loop. What it will do is it will access the code memory at the position of the program counter and take that as the instruction to interpret now. And then it will just increase the program counter in order to achieve this fall through behavior of most of the instructions. What is that? That means that the default next instruction will always be the one that follows in memory directly behind the instruction that we are executing at the moment. Then we will, the interpreter will call the or will execute the instruction. And this will be something that will be dependent on the actual instruction that is found. So the execute thing is something that branches to the implementation of the particular instruction that is found at that point. So there needs to be some way of evaluating what the instruction code actually talks about. So, yeah, but as soon as the execution of the instruction is done, then the interpreter will just loop back to the beginning and try to decode the next instruction at the position at which the program, which the program pointer actually, what's that? The position where the program pointer actually points to. Yeah, and as you have seen, the program pointer is increased before the actual instruction is executed. That's on purpose. Mm-hmm. This helps the instruction to modify the program counter itself. That is something that is needed in case you want to manipulate the program control flow. If you want to do something like a jump or something, you need direct access to the program counter. So in these cases, what you do is you store a new value in there, and that's why you have to perform this automatic fall through beforehand in order to keep the opportunity for special instructions to manipulate the program counter themselves. So this, the only way to exit this whole thing is that there's a halt instruction. It's kind of that's something that terminates the whole virtual machine. So that's not covered in there. But you could probably do something like a guard for the halt, for example, like a flag over here, in order to do that to catch these halt conditions in a regular way. Okay, so much about the interpreter. Now, if we want to generate code for the register C machine, what is the crucial points here? So one of the interesting things is how expressions are actually evaluated in such an interpreter, and expressions come as kind of complex things, that complex structures that we get from our syntax tree, and we need to find a way to express to generate code with just very basic instructions. So there's we need to find a way to encode these the evaluation of these expressions, and Yeah. The idea for that would be to kind of divide and conquer the whole thing once again. So what we do is we generate code to compute the value of the sub-expressions of an expression and store the intermediate result in a temporary register, which is still free, and then apply the operator of the current operation that we want to compute the code to evaluate the expression for, and then continue with the larger expression and operator. So we do the whole thing in a loop. So this would be the general strategy to evaluate these expressions. What do we need in order to evaluate the expressions? What we had so far was code memory and the stack. So these two parts are something that we already know. What's now added to the whole system is the places where we can store data. And what are these places? We call them registers. We can name them by a large R and the register number as an index. And if we... one thing that we should probably draw your attention to is that we now differ between the concept of a local register. These are intended to be used during the execution of a method body, and the global registers. Global registers are used as soon as you leave a computation of a method body and hit, for example, a call. In these situations, you need to transfer data between one method body and another one. You can't do that with a local variable because a local variable has only limited scope to your particular body. So you need another set of memory locations, and these are realized by these global registers. So in case you hit a call, you write the parameter values into these global registers, save away your locals, and jump to the code of the target function or method and get your parameter values out of the global registers and store them in local registers once again. So that would be the intention of how I would want to use my registers. In order to not introduce too much clutter in my notation here, I also use R as a register here, but for global registers, I will take all the non-positive indices. So the global register start with R0. This will be probably used for some kind of return value, and then there's the other global registers that are now the indexed with a negative index. So yeah, these need a space in memory, and yeah, conceptually you could separate them from each other because they are intended to be used separately, but actually you can just use one area for them. Okay. This is what I said already. You can use these local registers for the for intermediate results if you evaluate expressions. If you have local variables for a function, you also use local registers. And those are the ones that you can store and restore from the stack in case you want to call some other method. Then you have global registers where you save the parameters of a function and also store the result of a function. Good. In order to generate the expression evaluation code now, we need to have some way of knowing which of the registers are still free to use for me and which are actually used at the moment, which have data that I still need to have. And for that, we will keep book in a single value, for which we will introduce a counter variable. This counter is something that we will add as a parameter for our code generation function, and this will we will have to keep book about the next free register that we can still use, and if we do so in a sensible way, then we will end up with non-confusing code in the end. Okay, so let's do examples for code generation. So if we do so in the context of expression evaluation, we can have a look at what are the basic components for us. Well, for example, the constants. And if you want to use a constant in our program, we might have to load it in a register. So what we will do there is we will have an instruction, load C for load a constant, and we will have to provide it with a register where we want to move the constant to. So that's the thing that we will keep it in the front. This is the target register, and then there's the constant. The other quite simple thing that we might want to do is we might want to move some value from one register to another. For that, we can do this move instruction, and we will move the content of register RJ to register RI. So that is the semantics for that. And with that, we can already specify code generation for or the code generation function for a few simple things. Let's start with the code generation for if we find a constant somewhere in our expression tree. Then we what we define on this one is, yeah, this is the code generation function, or one part of the collection of functions that I will use for code generation. It has a name, of course. This is the code generation for R values. R values are values that can appear on, well, for you, on the right-hand side of an assignment. So this is why we will be talking about code R, code generation for R values. This code generation function will have several parameters. For once, it will have the first parameter, which will be the component for which we want to generate code. So these will be, in the beginning, these will be varying forms of expressions. Later on, it will be statements or even complete functions. This is the point where we have the connection to our syntax tree. So for each subtree that we have to treat, for which we have to generate code, we will find it somewhere in this code generation scheme. So in this case, it is integer constants for which we have the code generation scheme. And yeah, what we will do with that, we will see later on. What are the other components? Well, there's this one over here. This is the environment. This gives us the mapping from names to actual to actual bindings. So this is the what we did with our symbol table visitor before. So this is also something that we will that we'll carry around through our code generation thing. And the last component is the small I over here. This is the counter for the next free register. So this will tell us where we can safely which register we can safely use, and not only which single register, but all the registers that have at least the number that we find over here are the ones that we will be able to use for code generation purposes. Okay, so with this set of parameters, we now specify how we want to generate code. So, for just a constant, what we have to do is we want to have the constants in a way that we can use them in places where sub-expressions are expected, and for that we need to transfer them to a register. So what we do is we do a load C in a register. And which one are we using? Well, we know that all the ones that are indexed smaller with a smaller value than I are already taken, so we will take the first one, which is free, which will be RI. So this is the one that we will need to move into, so to move the constant into, so we will generate load C RI from of C. Okay, the next one that we will use is the code generation for a variable. So for variable X, we will when we want to compute with a value that belongs to this thing, we first need to look up the place in memory where the value for this variable resides. So for that, we will check our environment here for the name X, and we have seen over here as kind of the precondition for the whole thing, X is bound to A, which is then the memory slot for that. So we will find the value of X in the local register RA. So we will do a move from RA to RI. Okay. Apart from that, we can also have a look at what we want to do when we do an assignment. So the code generation for the assignment of the expression E to a certain variable X. How do we do that? Well, the idea is to compute the value for the expression into some free register. That is something that we do by calling the code R function on the actual expression that we have here. And we, at that point, I is the first free register. That's something that we will hand over to our code generation for the expression, and it will at some point use this register I for storing its value. We have seen that we have, for example, done so for the constant and for the variable that we hit here, and that's kind of the convention that if you start the code generation at with the first free register at I, then we will expect the computed value to be found in I afterwards. And with that, we can then move this result from RI to the place for variable X, which we can once again look up in our environment, such that we can generate the move from temporary variable to the known place RA. Okay. Yeah. So that's something that's not completely unfamiliar. You have this convention with having the target or the destination as the first parameter, also in certain other architectures, so that should not be too difficult. Yeah. Now, apart from the basic expressions, what can we also find in our instruction set? Well, there's also instructions to handle with or to deal with the sub-expressions for all the arithmetic expressions, which are this add, the subtraction, the division, and all the operators that you see listed over here. And all of them are kind of binary operators, which operate on two sub-expressions. So what we introduce for that is always the operator itself and its target and its two parameter sub-expressions. So this is the format in which we have instructions for all our basic instructions. And if we at some point hit one of these operators in the expressions of our syntax tree, then we will call our code instruction, code function. This in this case, it has as first parameter here the whole expression E1 operator E2. And what is the code that will evaluate the whole thing? Well, in order to evaluate the operation, we first need to evaluate both of the parameters. So that's what we're going to do. We will call the code functions for E1 and E2 separately. And we need some way of organizing the result so that we will find it afterwards. So what we will do is, at first, we will give the first of our calls to the code generation function. We will say that I is actually our next free slot in the registers, and it may use all the ones that that are greater than I also, and it will for sure do so. And the only thing that matters is that as soon as the evaluation is done, the only interesting part is the value that has been remaining in the register I, because that is the one that we are going to reuse. And for our second parameter, we will call the code generation function with a larger number for our first free register, so that it will never overwrite the intermediary result that we have computed for the first operand. And once again, we will call the code generation function here, but this time with our second sub-expression. And yeah, as soon as that is done, we have all the intermediary results that we need in order to compute or evaluate our larger expression here. And for that, we will use for the operator over here, we will use the instruction that belongs to that, and reuse the sub result from RI and R. Luckily, and ry plus 1, and apply the operator on them, and the result will be stored once again at ry, because that is the first free register, and we are also supposed to generate our expression code into register I. Okay, so for example, if we do that for the expression 3 times 4, what we will do is we will call the code generation function for the expression 3, because we had it here. And then we had the sub-expression 4. We will call code R for 4. And then what we will do is, well, our first free register was 4, so what we will do is we will do a multiplication with the target register 4, and we will collect our intermediary results from 4 and 5 and use them in this multiplication. And yeah, this is just our local definition here, but it uses calls to other code generation functions, which we can inline, and we will get the corresponding code for the constants, which will just do load constant of the of 3 and 4 into the appropriate registers. By the way, there's, I think, a sheet on the homepage where you can get all these code generation functions in one spot, so you don't have to write them in on one sheet yourself. Yeah, the whole system also works for larger expressions. In these cases, you just have to manage the first free register counter in the right way. So yeah, but you've already seen how to do that. The main thing is that you have to do different parameters for each of the sub code generation calls over here, and this will end up in inserting the right places in the code for the sub expressions. And if you do so, you get lengthy chains of instructions that in the end will not overwrite any useful sub expression that you still need for your addition in the end, in this case. Yeah. Okay, so much for evaluating the expressions. Here's for a summary the semantics of the operators for things, but I think you can get them in a separate sheet also from the homepage. Yeah, there's also unary operators, but there's not so much changing from going from binary operators to unary operators. They're even simpler. You just have two parameters. Yeah. So that's nothing too fancy. If you, for example, have the unary operator minus, and with that you can switch the sign for something, and this will have an associated operator or instruction neg. And yeah, in order to save space, we can just reuse the same register, so it will, in most of the cases, will always be called with just the same with the same register. Yeah, so that's the semantics for that. Yeah, and where do you need this kind of code R? Well, I said it would be the code generation for the right-hand values of some assignment. So the assignment is the thing that is important for that. So where do we need it? Well, in an assignment, like in a situation like here, where we have the environment where X maps to the first free local, Y is the second free local, and Z is the third free local. And, well, if we want to compute X is Y plus Z times 3, then we need to call the code generation function. Note that this time we have used 4. Why did we use 4? Well, 4 is the first free a place in the locals, in the local registers, that has not been allocated with a local variable, so we can use it for computing or for evaluating our expressions. And yeah, that's what we're going to do with that. So for evaluating our code, for generating the code for our assignment with code 4, what we do is we will move the final result from our evaluation of the expression into the register that is belonging to the variable X, and this is register 1, so we will use register 1 as the target. And apart from that, we will have to evaluate the code for the whole expression first, so that's what we're going to do here. And yeah, the first free variable where we want to have our to find our result afterwards will be the one that we'll give here to the code method. And then we will have all the steps that we have seen before. So we will have a lot of code that has to be glued together. And in the end, we will have a sequence of instructions that do evaluate our expression. Four missing. Okay, yeah, so much about expressions. I think that's not so hard because they're already in a tree, and all you do is just visit the tree. You don't have to do any fancy control flow manipulations. But now let's go to statements and control structures for our programs, because that are ones the more interesting from that perspective. What you already have seen, kind of hinted on the last slide, is that I used or that I like the name code for my code generation function. So this will be the kind of general code generation function. And what I have defined beforehand was this code R function, which we used when we wanted to evaluate an expression inside some kind of statement into a free variable and into free register. And those two are kind of connected in some way. We have already intuitively done so on the last slide, but in a more regular way. What do we have to do? Well, for an expression, we already know how to evaluate that code R, and especially for the assignment expression, we already knew what to do here. However, the same code is also relevant for if we just add a semicolon at the end, which will make the whole thing as a statement. So what's actually done is it's just the code generation for an expression statement is just it's just doing nothing. It's just calling the code generation for the expression. So an expression statement is pretty easy for you to handle. The temporary register is ignored, and the expression is evaluated as it is, and the only thing that happens there is kind of a side effect that is happening here, and that's why this assignment here is so crucial. That is the one that actually has the side effect that that fills the representation for variable X with the according value. Nevertheless, you can in C, for example, have things like these assignment chains. And why is that relevant here? Well, you will have the inner expression evaluated to some register RI, and this will be this assignment doesn't add anything to the value, but still keeps its right-hand side value in this RI and can be given to the next assignment that follows behind that. So an assignment also has a value in that sense. And with this code R thing, you get the whole thing for free. So, yeah, with this technique, you can have the expression statements already. Yeah. Statements are things that you can put in sequence one after each other. So for that, we will have to specify how we do that. And yeah, if we have the code generation of a whole list of statements, that's something that we also get from the syntax tree, then what we do is we will just generate the code for the first statement and then continue with the rest of the list. And if we are at the end of the list, we won't generate anything more. So sequences of statements are not very difficult to translate. Then there's things that that can break our control flow apart. So with that, we won't do our standard fall through from one instruction to the next, but instead we will go to another place. These are things we call jumps, and what is a jump meant to do? Well, the only thing that it will do is semantically it will manipulate the program counter in order for the interpreter to then check a different destination in our code memory for our following instruction. So that's what the jump does. Doesn't manipulate the stack, but instead does a new value into the program counter. That's not the only thing that we can do. There's also the conditional jumps, these are jumps that are depending on the value that is in the certain register. So if you do a jump zero on the register RI, what we'll do is if the value in RI is not zero, then we will just do nothing. That's just a skip. In these cases, we will just fall through and rely on the interpreter to just read the next instruction. And in case that the value in RI is actually zero, then what we will do is we will manipulate the program counter to the label that we are given. So that's something that in this case is it's not really specified whether that's something numerical or symbolical, but later on we will see that we can just use symbolical names for that. Yeah. So back to control flow in our programs. If you want to translate statements different from plain expression statements or statement sequences, we also need to look at conditional statements, which are, for example, if statements. And these are statements that have different parts. So there's a condition attached to the if, and we need to evaluate the condition, and that is the one that we then will depend on whether our control flow goes to the follower or to somewhere else. So we need to as soon as we hit such an if construct, we need to keep several possibilities where we continue our execution, where the control flow is actually going, and therefore we will use this jump zero afterwards. So as control flow is then not linear anymore, we will have different fractions of code that will be connected via control flow, and in compiler's view, there's the concept of a basic block, which is just a sequence of instructions that is not interrupted by any such control flow change. There's no in a basic block, everything is just linear. It's just a sequence of instructions. There's no call. There's no branch. It's just one thing after each other. And with these basic blocks, in the end, you will generate your program code. You will need to address these basic blocks. You will might be tempted to shift them around if you want to optimize your control flow with for specific reasons, like you want to keep the code in. Well, for example, you have features of your hardware that that do kind of pre-process the code that is following. In these cases, you want to keep the code as linear as possible, so that there's no branches somewhere in the middle, because that would make your speculative accesses that the hardware does, this would screw them up. And so these are certain conditions that you want to integrate into your optimization process, how you want to lay out your code. But in general, what you get is you will have different basic blocks, which are just sequences, and you have to linearize them in some way. Yes? That is also one of the criteria that will determine how you want to lay out your basic blocks. Yeah. So there's also certain architectures where you can, as a compiler, where you can set certain flags where you indicate which of the branches are the ones that are most commonly expected to be visited. And in these cases, you can also give the architecture hints where how it should perform its speculations and all these prefetching. And yeah, there's a lot that you can optimize here, but for our purposes, that all does not matter so much. For the RSEMA, everything that we will have, at least in the beginning, is that we will have sequences of code, and at some point we will have a branch where with the condition probably annotated at one of the edge, and it means that the other edge is meant to be just the negation of the condition. And so there's outgoing edges that are either one if we have an unconditional branch. There's two outgoing edges if we have a conditional branch, and we have several outgoing edges if we have a switch, but that is something that is discussed later on. Okay. For the symbolic, that's probably not as important here. There's a little bit about optimizing the way that you specify your jumps. If you have the possibility for doing relative jumps, this enables you to do position-independent code, but that's something that's much too far for our virtual machine. What we wanted to talk about is how to come up with the translation of just a conditional statement. And it's actually pretty simple. What you need to do is the S should be this thing over here. So what we're dealing with is the code generation for the if statement, and what we need to do there is we need to generate code for the condition. So that is what we're going to do first, code generation for the condition. This will leave the value of the condition in the register I, then we will jump on the value of the register I, and in case that this is zero, what we will do is we will jump to the label A, like this one, and if not, we will continue with code that we will generate with another called the code generation function. In case you need to generate code manually at some point, somewhere in the near future, you should probably take care of that you don't every time you have to translate such an if statement, you don't every time use just a plain A, but please make sure that you have unique labels in there. And also in the jumps. So that's something that has been done wrong a lot of times in exams. Anyway, if statements do not always only have one body attached, but they also are in the quite common in the form where you have an else branch, which has another or code sequence attached, and well, there's no change in too much here. Apart from code generation for the condition, you now need two jumps, one conditional in the case that the condition evaluated to zero. In this case, you will execute the code for else. And in the case that RI is not zero, you will execute the code for T and then jump over the code that you would have done for else, so that you reach B. And once again, please generate unique labels for all your statements. Okay, so that's if statement in the example. Well, that's a lot of hard work to do by hand, so let's just use our slide magic. Ooh, and we have, it's just for time reasons, because you need that for the homework. If statements have these components, you need to generate the code for the condition. Then there's the first jump. That might be enough, but in this case we have an else branch, so we need a second jump. It's this jump over here. The first jump goes to the to this part, This is the then part, if I'm correct. And then there's the else part over here, which is terminated with the B. Is that right? I don't know exactly. Let's see. The else part is the second one, and the true part is the first one. So this is the part for else here. And this is the part for then. Okay. Yeah, by the way, I could have looked at the numbers. Okay, so if it's not the only structure that is using jump zero, there's also other statements that manipulate the control flow. Most prominently, the iterating statements, which is the loops. So in general, we have the while loop. What does a while loop have as components? It has a condition and a body. And, well, it's pretty similar than to the thing that we have seen before. We have to evaluate the condition. Then we do a jump zero in case that the condition is not valid. We will, that should be a B. So that is a B over here. In these cases, we would jump to B and leave our loop. Otherwise, we would fall through and execute the loop body, this one. And in the end, jump unconditionally to the start and re-evaluate our condition. And we'll see whether we have to reiterate through the whole system or not. So, yeah, it's the same components that you needed for the if. It's just an additional unconditional jump to the beginning of the whole if. So that's everything a while is. And then, it's no time for that. So the only thing that remains now as loops is the for loop, and the for loop is just a kind of a modded while loop. The only thing that's different is that we have an expression E1, which is for initializing, which is executed at the beginning before the loop is actually started. Then we have an iteration statement, which is there for incrementing our loop counter, which is executed right before we jumping back to our beginning. And for apart from that, everything is the same as the plain while loop. We still have our jump to the beginning, and we have our jump to the end in there, and yeah, that's all. And you get all these components just from the syntax tree. Okay, I think we're done with the basic statements here. Switch statement we're going to do next time. So, yeah, I'm going to end today. Wish you a nice week, and let's see us next week. Bye-bye.